my first day on the job, July 1st, 1981, saw the first patient with Kaposi's sarcoma that had been admitted to the hospital just 2 days previously.
AIDS spread very rapidly in the homosexual community. It is not a homosexual disease.
Literally half of the gay men in San Francisco were infected with HIV.
1 week we had 2 cases, the next week we had 4 cases, by the end of the month we had 20 cases, and 2 of them were already dead, or 3 were dead, and it was devastating.
I don't think anyone who was not there then in this group of people could imagine what it was like. It was like literally being in wartime.
I was one of those people who didn't believe that the virus that kills fags, sex workers, drug users, and black people. I never believed a virus like that could exist. I thought it was Reagan's wet dream.
It was during that period, 81 to 85, that it became clear that this is a virus and it had a name, that we could test for evidence of infection, that there were many infected people, we knew how it spread, and the worldwide distribution of the virus also became clearer. Now, I kind of end that period in mid-1985 at the first International AIDS Conference, which was held in Atlanta in the United States.
We planned the first International AIDS Conference in Atlanta in 1985. And it began with a small group of perhaps 2,000 international investigators and physicians and other interested people.
There are new warnings tonight that the AIDS virus may have already infected 1 million Americans.
Heterosexual transmission of AIDS was a major topic as 2,000 scientists from around the world gathered today in Atlanta to discuss the disease.
Scientists say they are making progress toward a vaccine against AIDS, but it is probably years away. The prospect is that the incidence of this disease, for which there is no cure, will continue to rise sharply.
Very rapidly, the press became involved in these conferences. And the conferences became an annual or biannual update of concern, not only of information.
Paris, 2500 spécialistes assistent à la deuxième conférence internationale sur le sida. 3 jours de pessimisme, même si l'espoir de trouver un vaccin dans les prochaines années reste très sérieux.
Yeah, initially, of course, there were no drugs against the virus. It was such a horrible disease that there was this enormous urgency to find treatments initially for these opportunistic infections that we didn't know how to treat or didn't know how to diagnose.
This last year saw approval of AZT, the first drug found to prolong the lives of some AIDS patients. But side effects prevent many from taking it.
So when AZT came, you had a clear indication that it prolonged the lives of individuals. So the glee, the excitement of that was very soon tempered by the fact that the result was very temporary. We weren't sure why at the time, but it was clear that after a while, when you give a single drug, the virus very easily developed resistance.
Researchers at the third International Conference on AIDS learned how much grimmer the picture is today than it was just a year ago. This convention finds 6,000 scientists mulling over 1,300 papers, for the most part, 1,300 examples of how bad AIDS is. Just a year ago, it was thought only about a third of the people infected ever would get sick. Time is proving that tragically wrong.
Today, it was the vice president who came under attack as he defended the administration's new AIDS testing policy.
Free speech, that's what it's all about.
64 demonstrators were arrested by police wearing yellow rubber gloves, apparently for protection against possible AIDS infection.
We couldn't believe that the police were so poorly educated that they thought they had to wear, you know, huge yellow kitchen cleaning gloves to protect themselves, which of course immediately spawned a cheer amongst the ACT UP activists of, your gloves don't match your shoes, they'll see it in the news.
What was essentially accomplished during 1985 through early 1988 is, first, that an agenda was established. We described AIDS in a way that focused upon not only the virus, but on the social and political and cultural and economic impact of AIDS. We explained AIDS to the world, if you will, as a development problem, not just a medical problem.
Despite the fact that I was medically trained and I should have, I think, been more aware than other people, I felt at that time that AIDS had nothing to do with me, because as it was reported to be in San Francisco in America, and I was living in Uganda, and at that time I was not at all related to anybody who was a homosexual or who had been to San Francisco. I felt that at that time that AIDS had nothing to do with me, so that when I was told that my husband had AIDS, my first reaction was disbelief.
How many of you think that from now on until you are married, you'll be able to keep away from girls and have no sex?
At the Stockholm Conference, there was a big influence of focusing on Africa and other developing countries. It was the first time when we had a focus on people living with HIV/AIDS.
As of the 1st of June of this year, there have been now 96,433 AIDS cases reported officially to the World Health Organization from 136 countries around the world. That's approximately double the number of cases that were reported at last year's conference a year ago.
The one thing that was lacking at those conferences early on were the voice of people with AIDS. And it was the fact that people with AIDS were not present, that their voices, their feelings, their demands were not being heard, that made us realize we needed to go there and make our presence felt.
On behalf of people living with AIDS in Canada and around the world, I would like to officially open the 5th International Conference.
It was incredibly empowering for people who stormed the stage, for the world to, you know, be shocked into realizing that people with AIDS had rights, that their opinions and their thoughts matter.
Worldwide, as many as 450,000 people may have contracted AIDS. As many as 500 more people could be infected with the AIDS virus. Everyone has an interest in confronting AIDS. Everyone has an interest in making sure that this illness is beaten once and for all.
Why you don't?
His born son was a young man with a great cause. He had five lovely children, but he fell victim of the disease AIDS. That's the best way. We would wish to mourn this boy is by fighting AIDS.
And then after the 1989 conference, it was appreciated that the U.S. immigration policies were rather discriminatory, that they were interpreted as requiring people with HIV to declare their infection as they entered the country.
To remember how desperate it was then. There was nothing. There were no treatments.
People were dropping like flies. You could not walk down the street here in Greenwich Village without learning of somebody else. Somebody died, someone sick. It was a hideous experience. I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it. Nor do I want to. Nor should anyone else.
We faced massive protests in San Francisco. The representative of the U.S. government, they wouldn't send the president, but they sent the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Louis Sullivan, who attracted huge protests. And I knew, and not very many people knew, that on the other side of the curtains, behind the stage, there were 300 police. So the sense of being in the middle of this thing, and with a barrage of sound, something like nothing I've ever heard before.
In a unprecedented, as far as I know, sign of solidarity between the scientific side of the meetings and the patient side, there was a resolution passed that said we will not hold these meetings in any country that won't allow the patients to attend the meetings.
And what that meant was that we couldn't have the meeting in Boston, and that in fact we couldn't have the meeting in the United States again until the policy changed, and the policy hasn't changed, and so the meeting hasn't come back.
I would like to welcome you as chair of the 8th International Conference on AIDS, the 3rd World STD Congress.
It's my pleasure to introduce Ms. Elizabeth Taylor, founding national chairman and co-chair of the International Committee of AMFAR.
Now is the time for the West to share its resources with information to those very countries where it could reap the greatest advantage in lives saved and lives extended.
The only promise and hope came in the guise of effective treatments and prophylaxis for opportunistic infections. We're literally digging into our suitcases and doling out medications to our brothers and sisters from the developing world. And it's a lot of what I think made people like myself stand up and start yelling really loudly that every life matters, that every life has equal value, and that everyone deserves the right to health.
Depression in Berlin, and really because the results of the Concord AZT trials showed that AZT did not work on its own to prevent the progression of AIDS. So people were very disappointed, very depressed.
In Deutschland sind rund 70.000 Menschen infiziert, weltweit schon 14 Millionen. Bundespräsident von Weizsäcker warnte in seiner Eröffnungsansprache davor, Kranke auszugrenzen.
Oft wird AIDS an Unmoral gekoppelt, ja gar als angeblich gerechte Strafe interpretiert. Das ist eine entsetzliche, unmenschliche Ausgrenzung von Kranken unter dem Deckmantel vorgeblicher Moral.
Es sei dringend notwendig, den Entwicklungsländern Geld für Aufklärung und Vorsorge zur Verfügung zu stellen. Denn ein Impfstoff gegen das AIDS-Virus ist nicht in Sicht. Die Forscher schätzen, dass dies noch 1 bis 2 Generationen dauern wird.
At that time, the conferences were still annual, every year. After the 1994 conference in Yokohama, Japan, they moved to being every 2 years.
illness was no news at all, and even worse news. I guess the spread of the epidemic, the lack of treatments, the death rates that were going up and up and up. I can still remember the annual general meeting of the society, probably about 20 people and a dog turned up, you know.
When we went to Japan or when we went to Germany, those were the sort of the valleys, if you want, in the fight against the epidemic. I mean, things were not working very well. But we needed to get together to make that statement, to regroup, recharge, and then move forward.
We were involved in some of the early studies on dual combination therapy, and already that brought, I think that was already considerable progress, dual combination therapy, but of course it also didn't last. And then suddenly, when we learned to count to three, the world changed.
Particularly with the discovery of the protease inhibitors and the use of multiple combinations, three or four drugs, did you have for the first time a dramatic effect so that the viral load went below detectable levels, and it really transformed people's lives.
Thank you for attending the 11th International Conference on AIDS in Vancouver.
This experiment is in progress. No patient has been cured, but we must find out whether it is possible or not.
I think that the developments we've seen are leading us to believe that many things that we once thought were impossible are now at least within the realm of the achievable.
That was just, it was just bliss. I mean, it was incredible, incredible.
It is my life, it's my career. And having seen the epidemic unfold, having watched so many people die, and then seeing the world change so dramatically.
We have seen a growing list of accomplishments, which has contributed to a renewed sense of optimism and hope that greater and greater control of HIV disease can be achieved.
And yeah, we overreacted. I was guilty of having tears in my eyes thinking about the possibility of a cure, and we still haven't seen that, but it's almost as good.
The theme of that conference, ironically, was One World, One Hope. Suddenly the theme One World, One Hope didn't really hold true, you know? Suddenly people realized that it was two worlds and one hope for the rich world and everybody else watching and dying.
Okay, can you breathe? Get it out for me.
So 3 years ago, when I ended up sick in the hospital, I sort of thought that might have been my turn, because I had watched one friend after another get progressively sick and die. But I was just very lucky that I didn't get sick until the time that I did. And at that point, protease inhibitors were just around the corner.
Your viral load has jumped up again a little bit to about 28,000 copies.
I came home from my pharmacy one day and with a small bag of medications, but they were very expensive ones, and I decided to add them up. So I took my receipts on each of them and got on my calculator, and I said, my God, I brought home more than $5,000 worth of drugs for me today in one day.
Right now, we have to be realistic that while certain advances in science, medical science, has occurred, the benefits will not accrue to the majority of people in the world because they're poor. It just simply costs too much.
In 1992, I started a hospice project in this temple. I asked for some money from the government and start the hospice project. Here we have a doctor, we have a nurse who can give them some medicine, but almost of our work, we like to look after them for die peacefully.
I feel very angry because in the rich country, they spend 25,000
$1 per year for one AIDS patient. And here in Phnom Penh, we have only $10, even less than $10 for an AIDS patient per year.
Between North and South, and with therapy being so expensive now, still prevention is the most important tool to try to stop this epidemic.
We want more treatment for Latin America. We don't have access to the medical treatment for people living with HIV AIDS.
Good evening. Welcome to the International AIDS Society 20th anniversary session, reflecting back and looking forward. It is my privilege, as my almost last task as president of IAS, to chair this panel together with Julio Montaner, our new president, and Craig McClure, our executive director. We started to think about this about 1 year ago with Craig, realizing that 20 years have been passed since the IAS was created. And really, I think that during these 20 years, we all together, IAS members and governing council and staff, we helped to make a difference in the field. So, in what way we try to commemorate this 20th anniversary with a series of speeches of former president and relevant leaders in the field that help us to, in some way, wrap up what has been the achievements during these 20 years. Before we start with our series of speakers, don't be afraid, they will only speak for 10 minutes each. So it will not be that long. I would like to welcome and ask for a round of applause for our new members and positions. First, our incoming president, my friend Julio Montaner from Canada. People from Vancouver, please keep quiet. Also, as a special satisfaction for me to introduce our president-elect, the first one from Africa, Eli Katavira. And also our incoming treasurer, and watchdog of our finances, Alan Whiteside from South Africa. Please join me in welcoming our new members in our governing council. From the US and Canada region, Chris Bayer and Sharon Wamsley. Sharon Wamsley as re-elected member. In Europe, we have one re-elected member, Michelle Kasachkin, and a new member, Anthony Posniak. From Africa, we have one re-elected member, Viola Omboluri from Nigeria, and four new members, Faustine Ngugile from Tanzania, Papa Salif Sow from Senegal, Robin Wood from South Africa, and Deborah Seudi from Ethiopia. From Latin America and the Caribbean, the new member is Celia Christie Samuels from Jamaica, and we have two re-elected members, Hector Perez and Celso Ramos from Argentina and Brazil, respectively. And last but not least, from Asia and the Pacific Islands, we have Dennis Altman from Australia re-elected, and Prapan Panupak and Sai Subsiri Raghavan from India as new governing council members. So, Craig?
Thank you, Pedro.
And thank you, everyone, for coming. This 20th anniversary session also doubles as our annual members meeting. So I want to welcome all of you members and anyone who's not a member. This is your chance to become a member. As Pedro said, this is a special year for us, 20 years of the International Aid Society. We've also been through a lot of change in the last 4.5 years since moving to Geneva. And in order to try and kind of capture the history from the times in Stockholm to the times in Geneva, the first Secretary General of the IS, Professor Lars Callings, sitting to my right, and I put together, with the support of Rodney Court, our editor, who's in the front, history of the last 20 years of the IS, and particularly as seen through the conferences, but also through the policy advocacy and education work that we've done. And the film that, unfortunately, we had to cut off because we are short of time is on a CD. It was in every delegate's bag. I think we got up to, 1996, so there's still another 12 years to watch. It will actually be re-edited and refined and then released as a documentary later this year. I would just like to thank all of the donors of this meeting, and in addition, the core donors of the IS. The core donors of the IS, the Ford Foundation, and then we have support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But it takes a lot of support to put this meeting together. So for this meeting, I want to thank the government of Mexico, and in particular the Mexican Ministry of Health, the government of Mexico City, the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, UNAIDS, WHO, the Global Fund, a whole range of bilateral governmental donors, Spain, Sweden, the Netherlands, Canada, Norway, Great Britain, Ireland, Australia, and France, and a number of private foundations, the Ford Foundation again, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation again, the OPEC Fund for International Development, the Carso Health Institute, the Pfizer Global Health Fellowship Program, the government of France, the ANRS, and our major industry sponsors, Abbott, Boehringer Ingelheim, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Gilead, GlaxoSmithKline, Merck, Pfizer, Tibotec, Verco, Roche is a commercial industry sponsor, and locally, Microsoft, Coca-Cola, and the MacArthur Foundation. Thank you all for making this event happen. I'd like to, without further ado, introduce our regional representative for the USA and Canada on our governing council, Diane Havlier, who will introduce our first speaker. Diane?
Thank you, Craig. It's now my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Professor Lars Callings. He's a graduate of the Karolinska Institute and has been working on the AIDS epidemic since the early 1980s. He worked with Jonathan Mann in the late 1980s. He is the founding father of the International AIDS Society, serving as its first president in 1988. At this time, he and a number of visionary leaders recognized the need for a global forum to address one of our greatest public health challenges that we face today. Professor Callings served as Secretary General of the IIS from 1994 to 2002. Among Professor Callings' numerous contributions include his role as a crusader for HIV prevention and for vulnerable populations. He is currently the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Eastern Europe. He has spoken out vocally against stigma experienced by those living with HIV. And he has spoken out against subordination of women that is guised under cultural norms. Dr. Callings, we welcome you, we thank you, and we look forward to your talk on the early years of the epidemic and the IIS.
Thank you, Diane. And my dear friends, I would like to say, both old friends and new friends, so many among you that I've been working together with for decades, I would say. So this is a real pleasure. About the early days of the epidemic and IS, I'd like to remind you about the sudden appearance of AIDS in the USA in 1988, which caused emotionally a shock due to the relentless, cruel, and fatal course of the disease in a rapidly increasing number of young and previously healthy people. Scientifically, it constituted a challenge due to the enigmatic course of the disease. The first time was chaotic, but soon enough it was obvious that we dealt with an infectious disease and the transmission routes were demonstrated. In 1983-84, a virus was found as a causative agent, and already in 85 a diagnostic test was commercially available. During the meantime, we had realized that a much bigger and heterosexual epidemic was ongoing in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. This rapid development prompted CDC in Atlanta to arrange an international AIDS conference in 1985. Gary Noble of CDC was chairman of the first international AIDS conference, which focused quite naturally on the biomedical aspects. Of course, nobody was an expert on AIDS or the causative agent from the beginning, as both were new to science. Most experience of AIDS research during these early days existed in the US and in France. Therefore, the second International AIDS Conference was arranged in Paris in 1986, and the idea was to alternate these conferences between France and the States, which also had to do with national prestige and glory. Consequently, the third conference took place in Washington, D.C. the next year, chaired by George Galasso of NIH, consistent with the U.S. policy to recognize the two major federal stakeholders, CDC and NIH. However, in North America, there were other pretenders which wanted to be acknowledged as organizers of this series of conferences, notably San Francisco on the West Coast, where the first AIDS cases had been reported, a big local epidemic was raging, and science was outstanding, with names like Jay Levy and Paul Wolpertinger. Boston was key contribution from Max Essex's group at Harvard on the causative retrovirus, and Montreal with the McGill University. When in Paris, during the second International AIDS Conference, the Canadians had arranged a promotional luncheon for the leading circles of AIDS researchers in an attempt to get the fourth conference to Montreal in 1988. As the competition between other North American candidate venues became obvious, and as actually the next conference after Washington should be alternated to Europe, I, as a dark horse, proposed Stockholm in 1988, Montreal in 1989, and San Francisco in 1990. To my consternation, it was so decided. I had just jumped on the sudden opportunity. However, this pointed to the haphazardly selection process and the need for a more orderly and less spontaneous policy. Therefore, IAS was founded during the fourth International AIDS Conference in Stockholm in 1988 in order to establish an orderly planning process to coordinate future International AIDS Conferences, which were growing in size complexity and importance. Already in 1988, the conference included 7,500 participants from 140 countries. A group of prominent scientists from different regions of the world met to formally found IAS, elect an executive committee and an advisory board. I have made these slides from the original document, so they are scanned and they look, as you can see, very original. But I hope that you can read them. The only one that many of you might not know is the executive secretary, Professor Friedrich Steinhardt of Munich, West Germany at that time, a well-known virologist, particularly about hepatitis virus. He was a great personality and a big heart, and unfortunately he died in 1992. This is how he looked, and perhaps one can see that he was a person who was committed to the cause. The advisory board at that time might be of historical interest because it is like who is who in the AIDS world at the beginning, and you will recognize several names, Fauci, Gallo, Hasseltine, who then moved on to the Human Genome Project. Jarrett, you might not know in these circles because he was a veterinarian who worked with retroviruses in animals, and that was very important at that time to know about the other diseases caused by retrovirus, though in animal, like in cats, like in cattle, and so on. Montagnier, of course, and Peter Piot. Among the African members, Bila Kapita should be mentioned. He was the head physician of the Mama Diemo Hospital in Kinshasa and played a great role in the beginning. Sulman Mbup, Fred Malo, so people still are active, and from Asia, Oceania, David Cooper, of course, and Prapan Panapak, who is here. He seems to be as eternal as I am. and very nice for me to meet him again. The aims of the International AIDS Society, as seen already in 1988, might also be of interest because not so much has changed, because they actually illustrate the heart of what we are doing. For instance, to organize annual conferences and what we called at that time small subspecialty conferences in AIDS, which we have seen now, to add international status and recognition to AIDS research, prevention, treatment, and control. It was very important to get stability to how AIDS and HIV was considered at that time. To represent the scientific community as a voice of reason in AIDS controversies, which has been very important during the years. As an example, we already on the World AIDS Day in 1988 issued a declaration, Scientists Against AIDS Discrimination, which was even more obvious than, even if it's very obvious now, a lot has happened actually. This is too long for you to read, it's just to show this original document, and I will not dwell on that. It's interesting that the objectives of the International AIDS Conferences was formed together with the Global Program on AIDS. I worked together with Jonathan Mann to write these objectives, and you will recognize many of them. For instance, to create an environment conducive to effective communication among participants and to inform the media and public, and to foster a global approach to the pandemic and to promote international participation and solidarity and respect for human rights and dignity of people living with HIV/AIDS. I like to mention that already in 1988 in Stockholm, we had a program, an important part of the program, what was called the Face of AIDS, was when people living with HIV/AIDS was contributing to the conferences and had a specific role in the conference. The politicizing of the conference and influenced by activists had started already during the Washington conference with protests against President Ronald Reagan's dilatory and reluctant approach to AIDS. Yes, even his aversion to get his tongue around about AIDS. Even when already tens of thousands of his countrymen had died of AIDS. The activism and advocacy exploded during the Montreal and San Francisco conferences in 1989 and 1990, as you could see on the film shown before the formal part of this presentation. A newspaper headline, International AIDS Conferences Will Never Be the Same After Montreal, captured the sentiment of the following conferences, which has incorporated political discussion and activist protest, demonstration, and debates. It is important to mention that the IS policy of avoiding violence by police and security has largely prevailed, balancing freedom of expression and protest action. In the name of shortening my presentation, I just like to finish by mentioning that in 1994, the IIS was reconstructed. We had before only honorary officials, and there was a need, particularly after the death of Fritz Steinhardt, to have permanent secretariat with an employed secretary general. And the staff was very small at the beginning, as I'm showing in this yellowed family portrait. That was me and with two assistants. That was the entire staff at the beginning. I like to finish by saying that I'm deeply grateful to have had the possibility to serve IS, and like to thank you for this opportunity to wind up some experiences during some defining moments of the IS history, and to be with you once again and witnessing the ever-increasing importance and success of this great society. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lars. We're very honored to have you with us this evening. I'd like to introduce now Dr. Jerry Kouvadia of South Africa, who will introduce our next speaker on the basic science of HIV. Jerry?
So my colleagues on the table and members, it's my pleasant duty and responsibility, really, to introduce a figure who's been central to the IAS during my sort of, I guess, 18 years association with the body, and that's Mark Weinberg. I'm not going to spend too much of time on his academic accomplishments. You know them. He's a professor of medicine, microbiology, and immunology. And it always amazes me how North Americans are professors in three major fields, each of which requires at least 5 or 10 professors in the developing world. But Mark and people like him achieve things which are almost impossible for us. Mark is a director of research. He's mostly at the Jewish Hospital in Montreal and works at McGill University in various positions. He's had numerous awards. He belongs to numerous international bodies as an advisor. He's worked mainly in drug development and has been responsible for the development of the very important one, 3TC, but he continues to expand his interests outside of that to issues like PrEP and to microbicides and so on. But my main purpose of introducing him now is to tell you that he's been the president of the International AIDS Society towards the end of the 90s, and he was the co-chair of the very successful Vancouver conference. However, to me, the most important contributions that Mark has made is that it is not, I'm sure it's not, hasn't missed your attention that much of the emphasis of the AIDS conferences before 2000 were in the developed world. And most of the problems, probably 70 to 60% of the problems, were in developing countries. And it is to the foresight and the vision of Mark as president in the latter part of the 90s that he fought for with some of his other colleagues in the IAS to bring that conference to Durban in South Africa as a symbol of the movement of the issues of the developed world to the problems of the majority of AIDS sufferers. And that's quite an accomplishment. But in a way, it resulted in much, much more. Because what he did required a little bravery and some courage. Because you must, to recall for those of you who don't remember, it was a particularly fragile period, a very dangerous period, in fact, for science. It was a period in a country where there were challenges from the highest sources, almost unique in a democracy, to the very idea of science and the causes of HIV/AIDS. And Mark and his colleagues made it possible to fight that. It made it possible to mobilize 5,000, if I remember, scientists, at least 10 Nobel laureates, in a declaration, which was important to say to people in power that you can't judge against science and scientific methods and discovery. And that was called the Durban Declaration. I can go on and on. The impact of that meeting reverberates up to today. Craig is laughing.
Please don't. Don't go on and on.
Okay. I think Craig wants me to stop. But anyway, he thinks you get carried away with what we achieve. But it has left a legacy that has been almost unparalleled. And I'm really grateful to Mark, who has actually made that possible. So, once again, it gives me great pleasure to ask Mark to come here, and I look forward to hearing him speak.
Thank you very much, Jerry. And I must say that one of the highlights of my personal life was to have been president of IAS at the time that we organized the Durban Conference. I began my lifelong fight with President Mbeki of South Africa during the days and weeks and months leading up to the Durban Conference. And unfortunately,
it's a fight that still continues because he's still the president of South Africa, and I'm a long time has been past president of the International Aid Society. So with that in mind, I also want to pay tribute to Lars Collings and really pay tribute to his enormous memory skills. He remembers everything about the origins of the International Aid Society. And to give you an indication of how we are different as individuals, my own memory is not anywhere near as good as Lars. So when I was looking into the question of the International Aid Society, I actually decided to do a Google search. And if you do a Google search, IAS, which is what I put in, you bring up the International Association of Sufism, a nonprofit NGO of the United Nations. And you can see here that there's a picture of the Dalai Lama on the right-hand side in San Francisco. He's meeting with the co-founder of the IAS. But I'm sorry, I don't see Lars Collings in this photograph anywhere. I show you this because, of course, we are in the days immediately preceding the opening of the Olympic Games to take place in Beijing. And I think, as many of you know, I made a conscious decision, along with, I think, many of you, to boycott the Olympic Games this year, to be here instead in Mexico at the conference of the International Aid Society. Even though, of course, I wanted to show solidarity in the fight for an independent Tibet, but you probably don't know this, I gave up my place on the Canadian Olympic, athletic potential. Someone else is taking my place in the high jump. So, Jerry made reference to drug development. And, oops, I went too fast. I want to first begin with a photograph of someone who's a dear friend, and she's sitting in the third row, Françoise Bavé-Sinoussi. Because if we talk about accomplishments in basic science in our field, I think we have to acknowledge that the discovery of HIV, the first isolation of this virus, really gave forth to everything that we have accomplished in diagnostics and in drug development. Without the identification of HIV as the etiologic agent of AIDS, we would not have been able to accomplish any of the progress that has taken place these many years. And so I think we should all extend a deep appreciation to Françoise for her seminal work in this area. And we heard about drug development and drugs like 3TC, so I want to point out that the initial synthesis of the molecular structure that is known as 3TC, and for that matter, the initial synthesis of the molecular structure known as FTC, were conceived along with several other drugs that are still in development, one of which you heard about this morning, and it is apricitabine, ATC, a drug on which Pedro Kahn has actively worked. Give credit to the late Dr. Bernard Belleau, one of my colleagues at McGill University, a professor of chemistry at our university who conceived of the synthesis of these structures. And the reason, of course, that I say this is that if we speak about basic science research, we need to give credit to the chemists who really designed complex synthetic pathways that gave forth to the drugs. This is truly basic science, and unfortunately, we do not give enough credit to the chemists who have led us down the pathway of drug discovery that ultimately has resulted in the savings of many lives. But really, I also want to show a picture of perhaps other people whom you know, Ray Shinazi and Dennis Liotta, who took a basic structure and figured out how to separate enantiomers and come up with the structures
that represent the actual drugs that we use in therapy today. And of course, the list is way too long to mention in terms of each and every chemist who has contributed in a compelling way to the field, such as Dr. Holy, the founder of tenofovir, and many others. But really, one has to give credit to all of these individuals. What about all the rest of basic science? How can I possibly go through a litany of every accomplishment in the field? It's just impossible. So I thought instead I would just quickly run through the track A and the various subtopics, and I mean it doing it very quickly. Biology and pathogenesis, including all of these topics on the slide, basic retrovirology, viral diversity and bioinformatics, pathogenesis in all of its manifestations, the immunology of HIV, and HIV drug resistance, a field that, as many of you know, is still very close to my heart after all these many years. AIDS vaccines and microbicides and our quest for effective prevention tools will always be important to all of us. And as we said, drug development in all of these aspects is important. We've made progress in many of these areas, but clearly we need to make more progress. And of course, I want to underline that it is ultimately the clinicians whom we rely on to teach us how to use these drugs effectively, and without whose expertise we would also never have been able to make it to first base. Gene therapy, vaccine research, microbicide research. I think I can only point to this slide and say we now have a much better understanding of what will not work. I hope we will accomplish progress of a meaningful type in the next several years, and we've heard talks at this conference that have asked us to be optimistic, and I must say I agree with that approach. We have no choice. And as was stated so eloquently by Mike Cohn this morning, vaccine research must go forward, and we must strive toward the attainment of success. And it doesn't matter how many years it takes, we have to accomplish this goal. Prevention science, PrEP, is the new great hope. I think it will work, but let's stay tuned and find out. And thanks to all of you for your attention and for having given me the opportunity so many years ago to have served as your president.
To introduce our next speaker. She's the only member of the panel who has not been president of the IIS, but I think that perhaps in the future she might be. Kate Thompson is the Chief of Civil Society Partnerships at the Geneva headquarters of UNAIDS, and has been active in the field of HIV since her own diagnosis in 1987. That same year, she set up Positively Women in the United Kingdom, and then became a founding member of the international community of women living with HIV and AIDS. In 2002, she moved to Geneva to be part of the founding secretariat of the Global Fund to Fight HIV, to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, and then moved over to UNAIDS in 2005, where she also founded UN Plus, a staff association of UN employees working across all UN organizations throughout the world, including HIV-positive directors, technical experts, every level within UN, including drivers, in the field, working for UN offices. She's my great friend. I have enormous respect for her. At the risk of being politically incorrect, I think she's one of the sexiest, most dynamic women I know. Kate Thompson.
Good evening, everyone, and thanks, Craig. Tonight I'm going to share a brief personal perspective on the history of positive involvement, both in the AIDS response and the international conferences. But although it involves many individuals who all have their own memories and versions of events, the history of our involvement is by nature a collective history. It's our collective action that has often been the most effective vehicle in moving forward the AIDS response. Without the passion, the courage, desperation, audacity, and sheer bloody-mindedness of people living with HIV throughout the last quarter century, I dread to think where the response might be today. When I was preparing for this presentation, it became clear that the information that exists on our history as people living with HIV is difficult to find. Unlike at this conference, where we have many hundreds of people living with HIV, so few were actually at those early meetings, and even fewer are alive to share their memories. But in spite of minimal information, it's still a tall order to encapsulate the vast history of positive involvement in just 15 minutes. We're talking about the engagement of many thousands of individuals spanning the whole globe, mostly unsung heroes whose voices never make it to the podium in events like this, and whose piece of the story usually gets lost. So what I'll share is a small, personalized snapshot of some key events and milestones from a very northern perspective. My own history of AIDS starts in the early 1980s, 81 or 82, when I was infected, most probably either in San Francisco or in Amsterdam. Around the same time, the first cases of KS, PCP, and other opportunistic infections were beginning to emerge among gay communities. In 1982, as GRID became AIDS, pioneering organizations such as the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, Gay Men's Health Crisis, and the Terence Higgins Trust in the UK were established by those affected. Some of you may have heard of the Denver Principles. These were drafted in 1983 by people living with AIDS during a national conference in the US. They articulated for the first time the idea that the rights and personal experiences of people living with AIDS could and should shape the response to the epidemic. And they provided a framework which subsequently informed the activism of positive communities. As you probably know, the International AIDS Conference was convened, the first one, in 1985. Participants were, to quote Dennis Altman, a bunch of medicos and a few gay boys. I imagine it was the same in Paris for 1986. Meanwhile, in Europe, Dietmar Boll, a German nurse living with HIV, decided to organize an international conference for people living with HIV. Plans came together and the first conference was held in 1987 in London. At around the same time in New York, people living with HIV and their allies came together to form ACT UP. Their first action was to demonstrate on Wall Street in New York to protest against the profiteering of the pharma companies. 87 was also the year when people living with HIV, including my UNAIDS colleague Eric Sawyer, who you may have seen earlier on, protested outside the International AIDS Conference in Washington and were confronted by police wearing yellow rubber gloves. Eric's boyfriend began a chant that was taken up by the rest of the protesters. Your gloves don't match your shoes, they'll see it on the news. In January of that same year in the UK, I received my HIV diagnosis. As a woman, it was impossible to access appropriate information or support, even though I was living in a household of gay men. It was through this desperate, unmet need for answers, for services, and for hope that I was catapulted into the dynamic, messy world of AIDS activism. There were a few people living with HIV, as we heard from Lars, at the Stockholm International AIDS Conference in 1988. David Barr, now of the Collaborative Fund for Treatment Preparedness, was among them. He recalls, one of the most striking things about the Stockholm conference was the lack of organized community participation. They had a presence, but not a strong one. But 1989 in Montreal was the real turning point for positive and community involvement in the IAC, when ACT UP, AIDS Action Now, and Reaction CEDAR stormed the stage at the opening ceremony, carrying silence equals death posters, Tim McCaskill took the microphone and officially opened the conference on behalf of people living with HIV. From that moment on, it was clear that the conferences must move towards greater participation of community. The same year, Grupo Pela Vida was founded in Brazil. The group's Declaration of the Rights of People Living with HIV and AIDS was adopted unanimously by more than 50 organizations. And meanwhile, an international steering committee was formed to organize future global people with HIV conferences. That committee later became the Global Network of People Living with HIV and AIDS, a network that continues to evolve and to organize international gatherings of people living with HIV, such as the Positive Leadership Summit, which was convened last week. I'm a relatively latecomer to the International AIDS Conference. In 1990, many of us living with HIV were excluded from San Francisco because of US entry restrictions on people living with HIV. So Florence 1991 was my first. I confess I don't remember anything about the science. I remember taking part in a protest against the US entry restrictions. I remember receiving fascinating insights on Florence from the art and AIDS historian Simon Watney, and I remember drinking far too much wine. But as far as the actual conference goes, in spite of being pulled onto the stage at the last minute to speak about women and AIDS, I felt a bit like an outsider looking in. We organized the People Living with HIV conference in London that year, by which time it was really truly global. During the opening, Jonathan Mann announced Harvard's relocation of the IAC from Boston to Amsterdam. He told us, this decision is clearly, unequivocally a result of US policy on HIV and immigration. It's an extremely serious matter when America's oldest university has to leave the country to host a conference about a pandemic. Let's hope we won't be disappointed again and that the wheels of the US bureaucracy will turn now and that the conference can soon return to the US. In 1992, a group of positive women came together for several days in advance of the IAC in Amsterdam, and we formed the International Community of Women Living with HIV. We took the stage during the opening to show the world that we refused to remain silent. Afterwards, members set up positive women's groups in countries such as Uganda, Malawi, Kenya, and Trinidad and Tobago. Berlin 1993 brought disappointing results on combination therapy from several clinical trials, including Concord. Moira Corton, at the time working for WHO, spoke on one of the plenaries on the role of gay men in the fight against AIDS. In that presentation, he also came out as living with HIV. He was the first person to be public about their HIV status in WHO and maybe in the UN. Sadly, he didn't last long in the system after that disclosure. Another first was the speech of the late John Mordaunt, the first person to address the conference plenary as a person who openly used drugs. Our memories of these conferences are so entwined with the memories of people who are no longer with us. In 1994, the Paris or JIPA Declaration was signed by 42 leaders of governments. It resolved to facilitate the greater involvement of people living with HIV in the AIDS response and gave a name to that principle. In spite of many advances to people living with HIV involvement at all levels in subsequent years, much lip service and not enough investment have been paid to JIPA. And there's still a widespread lack of understanding of the value of our involvement. According to my friend Ian Grubb from the Global Fund, a wonderful human ideal has been utterly dehumanized by a depressing UN acronym. But if there's one international AIDS conference by which those of us who are long-term survivors can measure our histories, it's Vancouver. For me, there's a life before Vancouver and there's a life after Vancouver. And those two are a million miles apart. My life before Vancouver had been a time of plummeting T cells and constant infections, of intense relationships and community solidarity as we buried friends on an almost weekly basis. Life after Vancouver miraculously and rapidly transformed this former reality for those of us in the North, and our lives shifted to another phase, one of slow realization that maybe we might not die so soon, that maybe we could dare to plan for a future. Many of us returned to work, and the volunteer element of UK-based activism faded. Meanwhile, a chasm appeared between those of us in the north and our friends in the south, who could not access affordable treatment and who kept dying. Vancouver was also the time that people living with HIV through GMP were included officially on the conference organizing committee. ICW joined the committee 2 years later. That year also saw the establishment of UNAIDS, modeling a new way of doing UN business and including people living with HIV and other civil society representatives on its governing board. In 2000, the Durban Conference brought the scientists to the communities most devastated by AIDS, and many were changed forever by this experience. Post-Durban, the broader AIDS community began to embrace the possibility of making access to art a reality for those in the South. This change of heart would not have happened without the plenary speech of Edwin Cameron and the visibility of the Treatment Action Campaign and other activists from around the world who joined them in a united voice to call for treatment for all as we marched together through the streets of Durban. In 2001, the UN held the first ever special session on AIDS in New York. Out of that was born the Declaration of Commitment, which took the spirit of GEPA to a new level and provided our communities with a valuable tool to demand more involvement and to hold our governments accountable. And out of UNGAS was also born the Global Fund, another crucial event in the history of positive involvement. Next year, at the 2002 Barcelona conference, Gro Harlem Brundtland told participants, "We are aiming for 3 million people worldwide to be able to access ARVs by 2005. A concept that was later developed into the 3x5 campaign, a significant moment in our history because, as my boss Peter Piot said some time back, to be a leader, you need to be alive. In March 2003, a network of people living with HIV and treatment advocates, the ITPC, was formed at the International Treatment Preparedness Summit in South Africa. From ITPC came the Collaborative Fund, which has proved that GEPA can be given life when communities are able to make their own funding decisions. Today in Mexico City, many millions of collective air miles later, I've been on the Community Program Committee for the last two conferences. I've seen firsthand the levels of involvement that positive communities have in the conference now. I've seen the IAS employing people living with HIV on its staff, and I've seen it join the Living Partnership, which organized the Positive Leadership Summit just last week. We're present in the committees, the plenaries, and more of the sessions than ever before. And over the years, people living with HIV have become partners in the response increasingly, not just as themselves, but as experts. More of us openly living with HIV are now working in the large global AIDS institutions. We've crossed from influencing through activism to another form of influence and a quieter, more subtle activism from inside. But what does this really mean for people living with HIV, for our communities, for this conference? How far have we really come? In many ways, we can see the evidence of our advocacy for greater involvement in the AIDS response and in the IAC. We are here in greater numbers. We have our global village. But is it really the global ghetto? And what more can we do to enable positive leadership in the IAS? Despite our best intentions, are we successfully facilitating a new positive leadership and involvement? Are we organizing conferences that effectively build links between science, politics, and the positive community, between activists and institutions? And how much longer do people like Jorge Saavedra and Edwin Cameron have to carry the weight of senior positive leadership in our movement? What is it going to take before we have an HIV-positive president of South Africa, a positive executive director of UNAIDS, or for that matter, a positive president of the IAS? I'm convinced that it's this type of leadership that is needed to get us to the next stage of involvement, when being HIV positive ceases to be something that people notice or remark on, when it's no longer a barrier to employment or other opportunities, when no one cares one way or the other about our status. So that's the question I leave you with here tonight. What more is it going to take to get us there? Thank you.
Now it's my time to introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is, it was supposed to be an Italian clinician, Stefano Vella, former president of IAS. Stefano couldn't make it because his mother is sick and he had to stay in Rome. And the new speaker has gently agreed to replace him in a couple of days. I could say that Julio Montana, who was born in Argentina and had his medical education there. Then he moved to Canada where he built an extraordinary career, becoming now the director of the BC Center on Excellence for HIV/AIDS, professor at UBC at the University of British Columbia, head of the AIDS division, and as such, I could describe him as a Canadian. But you know, Julio, living in Canada, born in Argentina, has always cared for the developing world. So his program not only cared for people in Vancouver, his program also has constructed very strong links with Latin America, with Africa, and other regions in the world. So Julio is not only an Argentinian, Julio is not only a Canadian, Julio is a truly international leader, both in terms of science and advocacy. And it might not be important for you, but it is important for me. I'm very pleased to introduce the new president of the International AIDS Society, my friend Julio Montaner.
Thank you, Pedro. As they say, I'm the eminent president of the International AIDS Society. Pedro is the eminent president of the International AIDS Society. And when the boss said, Julio, you're stepping in for Stefano Vella, I said, yes, sir, I'm stepping in for Stefano Vella. Stefano was kind enough to send me his slides. He sent a collection of about 96 slides. And if you know Stefano, he would have given the talk with the 96 slides. So I threw them all out and I started over again. And I hope that you forgive me for that. He already did. What I'm going to do for you in the next few minutes is give you a bit of a biased overview of what the relevant developments have been in the field of antiretroviral therapy, who really have changed the history of this epidemic forever. And trust me, I think this is only the beginning. The first decade of our fight against HIV is best depicted by this slide, which shows in red the very bad outcome that this disease had and the very little success that we had in the therapeutic front. The trends in annual rate tests were skyrocketing. And then came Vancouver. So there you go, the first decade in one slide. And as Kate said, quite rightly, we saw a tremendous transformation after Vancouver. I must confess that when we came up with the One World, One Hope theme, we didn't know what we were talking about. The reality was that the hope arrived much later than we had crafted that theme for Vancouver. Three things came together in Vancouver that allowed us to move the field forward. And the first one was John Mellor's recognition of the prognostic value of plasma viral load. This by itself was a very significant discovery, which really changed the way we looked at this disease altogether. The second development was the MERCRO35 study presented by Trip Gulley at the conference, which for the first time demonstrated that using protease inhibitor-based triple therapy in naive individuals, for the most part, you could actually achieve sustained undetectable viral loads, and that this, in turn, was associated with immune recovery. We contributed to that debate by bringing forward an alternative approach. This was triple drug therapy based with NNRTIs and two nucleosides. And I'm going to tell you a story that is something that most people don't know. We really didn't even hope that we were going to reach undetectable viral loads. Mark Weinberg will attest to the fact that in December of the year prior to the conference, 2005, we met at a meeting.
1995.
Sorry. In December of 1995, we met at one of those consultations that we were doing in, I believe it was Toronto or Montreal, whatever. And Mark called me aside. I was leading the Inca study that we call it. Mark called me aside and said, Julio, I think we have a problem. Most of the samples that you guys are forwarding to me appear that we're not able to grow the virus. I wonder if we're doing something wrong. Little we knew that we were doing something right. It was at that point that we rapidly ran those samples almost within a week. The first 6 months of accumulated samples using a test that we were exploring with Roche, a plasma viral load test that we didn't know what prognostic value had, and we surprised ourselves when we found that in a blinded study, approximately a third of the samples were actually undetectable. And of course, when the blindness of the study was broken, we figured out that most of those patients were being treated with triple therapy. If it wasn't for John Mellors that explained to us at the conference what the meaning was of an undetectable viral load, and if it wasn't by Trip Bullock's study that showed validated this finding, we would have been in the darkness still today, perhaps. And that led to the new recommendations, the IAS USA guidelines, which basically described the use of triple therapy and started the race for putting people in treatment both at the north of the world first and then after Durban in the south of the world. Outcomes changed dramatically, and that is still today. Among those who access treatment, the outcomes have improved dramatically, as shown by the parallel slide here, where you see death rates going down after 1996 and staying down quite low ever since. But then we run into problems. We run into complications, and you are all familiar with these kind of pictures. More recently, even the cardiovascular risk was noticed to be elevated in people treated with heart. Multiple complications made us shy away of aggressively pursuing treatment at all stages of disease. We became more conservative, and eventually things started to become more clear. And perhaps the single most important new development in the last while comes from the sub-study from the SMART trial, where it became apparent that actually, once again, it's more problematic for an individual to have unchecked viral replication than dealing with the side effects of the medications. And as illustrated here, patients who interrupted therapy during the SMART trial were found to have skyrocketing levels of IL-6 and D-dimer, both of them as markers of inflammation and intravascular clotting leading to cardiovascular risk, stroke, and other complications. More importantly, elevation of a variety of inflammatory markers has been associated with increased risk of death in individuals with HIV, once again demonstrating that, David Ho said at one point, it's the virus stupid, and it's not just about immunity, it's also about chronic inflammation. So in 2008, HIV infection has really been reassessed and is now understood as a chronic inflammatory disease. Inflammation is an important driver of non-AIDS events. This affects the heart, the liver, the kidney, and in due course, we're going to learn the rest of the solid organs in the body. This is also probably a factor contributing to the malignancies that we're starting to see in people with HIV. And inflammation, at the end of the day, is also an important driver of CD4 decline, leading to AIDS at the late stages of the disease. So we're now looking at HIV as a chronic inflammatory disease with two separate endpoints, if you want. One is multi-organ dysfunction throughout the course of the disease, and then a final stage of immune deficiency. The other thing that has happened in the last couple of years is that we have begun to understand that antiretroviral therapy is a lot more potent at decreasing transmission of HIV than we ever realized. That has allowed for the successful implementation of vertical transmission programs where we can use antiretroviral therapy to prevent infection of newborns. This has been extremely successful where access to triple therapy has been available both, is illustrated here in the USA and in Canada, for example. I have the denominator here of pregnancies occurring in HIV-infected women, and you can see a negligible number of infections among their newborn babies, and this is indeed very good news. And this has fueled an interest for us to look at the potential added value of antiretroviral therapy as we try to support our prevention efforts. And there are a variety of studies that I'm not going to describe that demonstrate quite clearly that lower viral load equates with a lower risk of sexual transmission. And the truth is that I would just say lower risk of transmission, full stop. I do acknowledge the fact that there is a debate ongoing as to whether or not a properly treated individual with a variety of other caveats is non-infectious. I'm not going to enter into that. From the public health perspective, I think that we have enough evidence to state that lowering the viral load in our communities will lead to a decrease in the transmission, and therefore we should aid our treatment efforts and our preventive efforts with a massive rollout of antiretroviral therapy. This is modeling that we have done based on real data from British Columbia, demonstrating that if we were to use antiretroviral therapy at the current rate, we will continue to see the stable epidemic. If we were to increase the current coverage with antiretroviral therapy from 50% to 75% of those individuals who have a medical indication, which is something that we can do easily, particularly now that we have expanded the therapeutic guidelines, as I'll discuss in a moment, we could see a very significant drop in new infections, as demonstrated here, which could be in the order of 50% or thereabouts. And notice also that the expectation is that this would be a sustained benefit on the epidemic. This conference has seen the release of the new IIS USA guidelines for antiretroviral therapy, and I think that most people have failed to read the fine print of these guidelines. I truly do believe that the guidelines that came out at this conference are going to revolutionize the treatment of HIV, totally change the way we approach this disease, because they incorporate, as I said, the fundamental principle that HIV is a chronic inflammatory disease. And although it is true that the table looks the same, the title looks the same, the authors look almost the same, the reality is that this is a dramatic departure from what the guidelines have been to date. The 200 CD4s now become the new 350 CD4s, but the thing that is most relevant is that there is no upper threshold where we now recommend that people don't be offered treatment, and we include a caveat whereby individuals who have a variety of other conditions, including excess cardiovascular risk or chronic hepatitis C or nephropathy or so on and so forth, a variety of other conditions, or even a high viral load, should be encouraged to consider antiretroviral therapy because of the deleterious effect that unchecked viral replication will have on their end organs and ultimately their survival. So for all these reasons, I do believe that Mexico will go down in history as the conference where treatment merit prevention, and we actually expanded the guidelines to greatly increase the number of people who should be on treatment. Of course, the corollary of this is that the gap between the north and the south will grow again. Our hope is that we will be able to roll out antiretroviral therapy even more aggressively in view of the benefit that this treatment has on prevention. As of recently, new numbers came out from the UNH, giving us a sense of optimism that we are starting to see progress in terms of our global impact with antiretroviral therapy. As it has been said earlier in this conference, the glass is more half empty than half full. We should be very cautious regarding this optimism. We're only beginning the fight, and this is a fight that is going to last for many years to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Julio. I just introduced the president-elect, and now it's my privilege to introduce our past president, Helene Gayle. Helene was trained as a pediatrician and in public health. She rose in the ranks of the U.S. Center for Disease Control to become director of HIV and TB. She moved to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in 2001 to become the head of HIV, TB, and reproductive health. And in 2006, the president and CEO of CARE, a position she still holds. From 2004 to 2006, she was IES president, our first woman president. And Helene will discuss an area she knows very well, the link between HIV poverty and development.
Thank you, Pedro. And I would just like to add my thanks to all of the panelists and all of my predecessors and colleagues at IAS. It was wonderful to hear Lara's history of IAS and for so many of us who count our professional lives by these conferences in so many ways and think back on how the response has changed through the eyes of these conferences and the contribution that IAS has really played to that. I just feel very proud and pleased to be part of that tradition. And so I just want to add my thanks along with all the others to my colleagues who are sitting here, as well as so many others who have made such a difference to this response and have played such an important role. I'm going to talk, as Pedro said, about AIDS, poverty, and development. And in many ways, what I'm going to talk about kind of mirrors my own professional career, first starting as a pediatrician, epidemiologist, researcher, public health physician. And I think as we who have been working on this epidemic started very much from a very biomedical perspective on this disease and have gradually grown to recognize that we can't look at this epidemic and the response without also looking at the broader societal context and some of the underlying causes that fuel the epidemic and that are very much a part of whether or not people are able to take advantage of the many things that we now are able to provide through better technologies, better knowledge of what it takes to make a difference for this epidemic. Let me just start with a quote by Rudolf Virchow, who's the father of pathology, and he knew back in the 1980s a lesson that I think we're just learning now, that disease and society are so linked. So he said, if a disease is an expression of individual life under unfavorable circumstances, then epidemics must be an indication of mass disturbances. And I think we recognize now that we can't ignore the link between disease and society. And so from the perspective of an organization that works on trying to eradicate extreme poverty around the world, I think our response to HIV very much mirrors our response to the way that we try to have an impact on the lives of the poorest of the poor around the world. We work in a way that tries to, and I'm going to talk a lot about the issues of AIDS, poverty, and development from the perspective of what we do at CARE, and so I'm going to use some of the examples from our own work to make clear how you can, in fact, use a development approach, incorporate the issues both of causes as well as consequences to be able to really look at a more comprehensive approach to fighting the epidemic. So as we look at our approach to reducing poverty, we look at both how do you meet people's basic human needs, whether it's water, access to food, access to health services, in an effort to provide help to attain the Millennium Development Goals. But beyond looking at basic human needs, recognizing that it's also important to look at people's social positions in life, whether it's promoting empowerment, equity, social inclusion, and all the things that we know have an impact on the lives of the poor and we know have an impact on driving HIV. And that if you don't also look at influencing the enabling environment and look at policies, social responsibility, and engagement of all aspects of society, we won't have an impact on making a difference. And that women are core to our efforts in reducing poverty, just like we know that women are core to the effort to making an impact on HIV and AIDS. And this just looks at the virtuous cycle that occurs, that no matter where you have an impact on the lives of women, you have an impact on creating a sustaining change that doesn't just help women, but also helps improve the lives of their families. Now, we know from all that we know, health, including HIV/AIDS, is both a cause and a consequence of poverty. The link that everyone in this audience knows so well, that poverty, whether it's the situation of lack of services, the inequities that come from lack of economic opportunity, exclusion, marginalization that come with poverty, clearly have an impact on poor health, and poor health also contributes to poor economic growth and poverty because of the illness that prevents people and their caregiver from being involved in income generation and affects productivity. And we know with HIV that affects people in the most productive years of their lives, this interconnection and link between poverty, poor health, and HIV is mutually reinforcing. And if we can break the backs of one, we know we can also break the backs of the other. We're involved in providing services in health in 350 programs in over 60 countries, and in a majority of those programs have a component of HIV and AIDS. So we are involved in over 200 programs in 40 countries working on HIV and AIDS. And again, our approach tries to address underlying causes, education level, lack of income, gender discrimination, and also helping to build local capacity of programs to increase the sustainability so that once we leave, communities have ownership of the response. I'm going to give a couple of three examples of programs that we're involved in, and then also talk about some research that we're involved in that really looks at and explores the issue of empowerment, particularly looking at how that affects women in the response to HIV. And these three different projects look at addressing some of the obstacles and underlying issues, the barriers, that no matter whether or not we have the best approaches to preventing, providing support, or providing treatment for people living with HIV, if we don't look at some of these underlying causes, we're not going to have the same long-term impact. So in Kenya, we have a program that looks at addressing barriers and linking services for PMTCT. In Rwanda, community ownership and psychological support for orphan and vulnerable children. In India, a project that looks at empowerment of sex workers. Let me just start with a quick example of Kenya in Nyanza province, where, as we know, in many programs, while the services for PMTCT are available, accessing those services is poor. We know that issues of stigma remain a major obstacle to accessing services. And that oftentimes, particularly for women to access these services, women are concerned about the fact that other needs aren't being met and that they don't have places to go to link to services for their children, for themselves, for their sexual and reproductive health rights, and overall basic family needs. And that oftentimes the capacity of the public sector where these programs are often located is weak and unable to provide the quality of services. This program looked at how do we overcome some of these obstacles, and without going into all of the details, looked at some of the things that we knew were obstacles to women actually accessing the services, improving the quality of the Ministry of Health to be able to provide quality services, making sure that services were linked with other related services, so that access to antiretroviral therapies, voluntary counseling and testing, and other related services, particularly family planning services, were available for women as they accessed prevention of mother-to-child services, insecticide-treated bed nets, and safe water for infant formula and for basic needs. But in addition to the strategies for linking health services, we recognize that without community mobilization to fight the things like stigma, gender-based violence, and the fear of violence that women had because they knew that if they were identified as a woman who needed these services, it was very likely that they would have repercussions within their families and within their communities. We provided support groups and buddy systems for women who are HIV positive so that they didn't have to go through this experience alone. And we provide savings and loans groups so that women's economic needs and food security needs were met in addition to these other. We saw over a three-year period of time that the uptake of the PMTCT services increased from 30 to 90%. So I think we saw that this approach to have a more integrated approach that met the needs more broadly really had an impact on the overall intervention. We changed social norms that perpetuated stigma, built a more supportive environment for women to seek the supportive care, and had a more integrated approach to the health services. Let me talk a little bit about a program that looks at orphan and vulnerable children. And this was a program in Rwanda, and it's called the Nkunabanda or I Love Children program. People know that the effects of the genocide in Rwanda combined with the devastation of AIDS led to a high number of child-headed households. These children were often isolated within communities. They were vulnerable to physical as well as sexual abuse and other psychological trauma as a result, and their basic needs were not met. This program helped to provide community mentors that were chosen by the children themselves, and these community mentors helped to provide basic life skills for children, school support, economic security, and food assistance. They also helped to provide basic livelihoods by giving small livestock, so people were able to actually meet their economic needs in the context of these child-headed households, and provide mentors the ability to provide the children the support that they needed. Results again showed that this type of model that integrated the overall needs and gave community ownership really had great improved results, with children enrolling in primary school, children who had otherwise been left outside of the school system. They were able to increase literacy, life skills, and households were able to gain other access to health services through health insurance, were able to get to other services that were critical for them and their caregivers. Now, just finally, the third project that looks at the issue of empowerment. And this is a project in India called the Saksham Project that looked at providing prevention support among sex workers in Andhra Pradesh in India. And it tried to focus on how to make sure that HIV-focused interventions addressed, again, the broader needs, not just looking at the interventions that were necessary that we know can reduce HIV, but looking at the issues that prevented women from protecting themselves from HIV, such as gender inequality, rights violation, discrimination, and stigma, acknowledging that condom promotion and knowledge alone were never going to be effective for women who otherwise faced violence, faced discrimination, and faced fear within the communities. The program worked by looking at establishing collectives and community-based organizations within this community, looked at establishing community-managed drop-in centers, mobile clinics, and particularly training sex workers as peer educators and giving them the sense of mission and purpose and empowerment. This led to, again, I think, encouraging results with increased rates of condom use. 80 to 90% reported in last encounter increased access to services, including STD services, screening, and voluntary counseling and testing, decreased levels of violence, greater sense of solidarity and unity among the sex workers, and an effective collective action to advocate with local authorities, particularly in the case of decreasing the violence that these women often faced by police and others in the community. We've tried to look at this issue of women's empowerment and HIV prevention because, as we all know, this is going to be key, particularly as we see increasing rates of HIV infection among women. This is just preliminary data from research conducted in six different countries to look at the impact and the implications of empowering women and what does it really take. We talk about this all the time, but I think understanding what it really is going to take to make a difference, to change the status of women and give them the opportunity to prevent their vulnerability to HIV. So there are three things that I think that we found, and again, These are things that I think we've known, but to be able to look at them and look at them in a variety of different ways, I think, puts it into perspective. So first of all, context does matter. In some contexts, women feel that they can make decisions on safe choices, and in others, they can't. This is a study that was done in Bangladesh that said sex workers reported that they do feel empowered to use condoms almost 90% of the time, 87% of the time with their clients, but only 30% of times with their spouses. And we see this over and over again, so it's not as if these women can't do it, but it's the context. So what about this context? I think these are the kinds of things we have to look into further. That solidarity networks, as simple as that may seem, can often offer a critical space for growth. In Burundi, 61% of members of solidarity groups went for HIV testing, compared with 27% of those who didn't. In the study in Peru, women said, sometimes when we go alone, it's as if we're not taken seriously. But if you say you belong to an organization, it fills you with energy and with courage. So we know that there's something about this sense of being part of a network that does give empowerment and really gives women the opportunity to do some of the things that they wouldn't do otherwise. And finally, we know it's essential to involve men, and we've talked about this in many forums, that when we talk about empowering women, we can't forget the fact that we have to include men in this response. So women say that their men in their lives must be included as husbands, as clients, lovers, police, taxi drivers. Again, from the study in Peru, they said, by being sex workers, we don't stop being sisters or cousins or whatever. And we feel the same for the seller on the corner, for the female cop. We're the same. And in the end, we're all women, and we feel the same. So I think these give us some lessons about what we still have to learn, but what some of the important ways in which we can look at not only the approaches that we know that make a big difference, but also how do we put some of those together in ways to really mobilize communities and look at some of the underlying issues that are the vulnerability for HIV, and also look at some of the factors that keep people from taking advantage of the strategies that we know work. Let me just close by a quote by Gandhi. I think we're all here because we want to make a difference. We've heard a variety of different presentations that look at a variety of different aspects of the response to HIV. But I think for all of us, this is a test when we think about our work and put it into context, whether we're looking at basic science, clinical science, poverty and HIV, or any of the ways in which we try to make a difference. And this is a quote that I often think of when I want to make sure that I'm doing whatever I can to make the biggest difference in the world. When in doubt, apply the test, recall the face of the poorest and the weakest person whom you may have seen, and ask yourself if the step you are contemplating is going to be of use to him or her. So thank you.
Thank you, Helene. I'd like to introduce now our Governing Council member, Professor Aikichi Iwamoto from Japan, to introduce our next speaker.
Executive Director of UNAIDS since its creation in 1995 and Under Secretary General of the United Nations, Dr. Peter Piot comes from an academic career focused on AIDS and women's health in the developing world. Dr. Piot earned a medical degree from the University of Ghent, a PhD in microbiology from the University of Antwerp, Belgium, and was a senior fellow at the University of Washington in Seattle. After graduating from medical school, Dr. Piot discovered the Ebola virus in Zaire in 1976. In the 1980s, Dr. Piot launched and expanded a series of collaborative projects in Africa, including Project CEDA in Kinshasa, Zaire, the first international project on AIDS in Africa. Born in 1949 in Belgium, Dr. Piot is fluent in three languages and is the author of 16 books and more than 500 scientific articles. He has received numerous awards for scientific and societal achievement, and was knighted as a Baron of King Albert II of Belgium in 1995. Please join me to welcome Dr. Piot.
Thank you so much, Professor Ito. I was IAS president in 1992-94, which seems like the prehistory or something like that. And the IAS was then run out of my office at the Institute of Tropical Medicine, which is kind of was like one-fifth of the size of this podium, and with a half-time person. And when I took it on, there was not even a member list. Now, this is the time to reveal all the secrets. when I ended, I shipped a few boxes to Lars in Stockholm. And Lars, you told me you have a picture of them. I must say that it was a very exciting time on the one hand, but it was a time when of Great Depression in the response, the original hopes that AZT or others in monotherapy would do it, they were soon collapsing. And this was a time when myself, I was still seeing patients, and I was wondering myself also, where is this leading? Are we ever going to find a solution or, to say the least, a treatment for people living with HIV? Unfortunately, a few years later, the hope came, and that was, and it changed forever how we deal with this epidemic, 96 in Vancouver. And tomorrow, there's a special session with Tony Fauci, where moderated with Richard Horton, so, and where I'll talk about the future. So I'm not going to talk really too much about the future. But I thought, you know, I will be a bit more provocative than usual. And I want to talk a bit about myths and facts, which I think are can be dangerous and have been a recurrent theme in the history of the epidemic. First myth is one that has come up recently again, and that there is too much money is going to AIDS. And it reminds me also of a letter I received at the, in 1999 or 2000 on behalf of all the donor agencies telling me that I should keep a bit quiet, more quiet, and not call for this all this money to deal with AIDS because, one, the money is not there, and, two, funding for AIDS will go down in any case. It illustrates also that even for people heading or in senior positions in donor agencies, that it's difficult to predict the future, because since then, there's about 20 times more money. And I'm glad we're not too much intimidated by what classically has been an approach in international development and in public health, and that is demand reduction. And making sure that, you know, we did not ask for what are basically rights, and that we did not ask for the full pocket to solve a problem. The truth is that, you know, there's not enough money going to AIDS. But also, of course, the truth is that there is not enough money going to other health or development issues. Governments, take Africa, committed in 2001 in Abuja to spend 15% of their GDP annually on health and AIDS. Very few are doing this. We have the commitment by donor nations to spend 0.7% of the GDP on, you know, on international development. And only a handful of countries, all based in northwestern Europe, are doing it. None of the G8 countries are doing it. We always talk about the G8 countries, and at the same time we forget those countries that are making a major effort. We have, here you see what the needs are, and they may even grow depending on how we, the price of drugs, particularly for second and third line treatment, will evolve. That is a major determinant of the future cost of this epidemic. And you see that the treatment gap is really continues to grow. We have a new attack, I would say, that is coming, and that people who are saying, oh, we shouldn't do that, we should not give all this money to treat these people with HIV because we're creating entitlement programs, and, you know, and that's unacceptable. I say there's maybe, you know, something that... it's entitlement to life is the absolute right thing to ask. So it is, again, a completely different perspective that we in the AIDS movement have from some people who have legitimate concerns about where the money will come from, but what we are saying, these are the needs and we'll find the money, we'll make sure it is there. But this is an extremely dangerous recent attack on people with HIV. It is immoral and it's unethical. And that's what we are faced with, and that's what we will have. We'll counter it. Don't worry. Remember the times when was said that Africans, they can't read the time on the watch, so we shouldn't come with antiretrovirals. And in any case, the health systems are not functioning and so on. That's not so long ago. And there is a myth that there's so much money going to AIDS. Here, look at this is from WHO estimates for total health expenditure in the low and middle income countries. This is figures for 2006, the most recent we have, was $644 billion. And in the same year, the world spent under $9 billion on AIDS. Just let's put things in perspective. And let's not be intimidated by this kind of demagogy. And all this is also going on, even though AIDS is the number one cause of death in Africa, the seventh highest cause of mortality worldwide. Second myth, and that's one that is particularly dominant in the countries like the UK. Invest in health systems and we will solve all the world's health problems, including AIDS. That's all we've got to do. And the fact is, of course, that weak health systems are a major obstacle to rolling out antiretroviral therapy. And therefore, it's excellent that for the first time ever at this international conference that there have been so many sessions dealing with the synergy between an AIDS response and strengthening health systems. It's not one or the other. But we shouldn't forget that even if we would have perfectly working health systems, that it wouldn't do much good for HIV prevention, because most of it, except particularly for mother-to-child transmission prevention, where a functional health system, particularly for women, is absolutely necessary, but it wouldn't work for community mobilization, men of sex with men, harm reduction, and so on. Key elements, sex worker interventions. Another myth that you hear, again, from people like Indifit and so on, is that the AIDS response deprives health systems of vital funds or is undermining them. Now, in 1976, when I was still a very young man and had much more hair than I have now, I was working in Zaire, and there was no doctor in a radius of over 150 kilometers, north, south, and west and east. There was nothing that you couldn't go. And as Margaret Chan said at the opening, in her opening speech, she said, we should not blame AIDS programs for the bad functioning of health systems. Coming for her is a great statement, because the evidence is not there. And the truth is that health systems have been neglected since before AIDS first appeared. So let's not blame the AIDS response on it. But AIDS itself has indeed undermined health systems in some countries, particularly in the worst affected. When I saw that, for example, Botswana, in a period of 10 years, has lost 17% of its doctors because of AIDS. There were other reasons in addition, and that's not uncommon in many of the countries in the region. You can say the same thing for nurses. And Alex Coutinho gave a plenary where he demonstrated clearly, if there is any evidence, that is that AIDS funds and AIDS funding and AIDS action have been the engine for strengthening health and development programs and have saved the lives of many healthcare workers, because healthcare workers are equally infected with HIV and sometimes more in some countries than the general population. And yesterday there was an interesting session on health systems organized by WHO, and people like Minister Tedros from Ethiopia, Minister of Health, he clearly gave a very pragmatic approach to all this. He said, okay, we have funding for AIDS. We've been using it to strengthen our services, even to build clinics, to strengthen the laboratory infrastructure, and so on and so on. Because when you introduce quality laboratory services for AIDS and for monitoring HIV, people with HIV and on their treatment, That, I can assure you, for sometimes introduces for the first time some quality assurance in that laboratory, in a clinical laboratory. And there are so many examples, and I think the evidence is now really accumulating. We have a lot of myths around prevention, perhaps even more. One is a general one. You say, oh, we don't know what works. That critique comes from academics and people who are saying, you know, it's because you need to end your article by saying more research is needed. And then what's not written there is, and give the money to my research, of course. I've done that as well, so don't, and I will probably do it again in my next job. But the truth is, and at lunchtime or this afternoon, we had in this very room a great session hosted by The Lancet, which is issuing a special volume on HIV prevention. The room was packed, and we heard really a great summary of the evidence, what is working. It's not enough. We need more effective interventions. We have not exploited, for example, synergies between behavioral interventions and treatment and structural interventions. And what Helene just showed, this is, are some very practical on-the-ground examples of what is possible. But we really have enough evidence for making it work. And there are, I'm not going to go over that, but there are enough empirical evidence now. There is enough evidence from the real world. But the fact is that prevention needs more attention, and it's been one of the great themes of this of this conference, to draw more attention to prevention and what to do about it. Well, I'm going. Yeah, another one that is myth is that say, you know, all we need to do is some, you know, very targeted interventions, and we don't have to care about anything else, and the structural interventions and changing the laws and all that. We now have empirical evidence, and you can find it in the last UNAIDS report, that in countries where there is a supportive environment, particularly when it comes to the most vulnerable groups to HIV infection, sex workers, injecting drug users, and men of sex with men, that where there is a positive environment, there will be better outreach to the prevention, and that saves people's lives. If you count to harm reduction, if homosexuality, to use the term, the old-fashioned term, but is illegal, if sex work is completely legal, we can't do our job, and that costs lives. And we have some empirical evidence there. So it's not touchy-feeling from some development or human rights people. It is really making a difference. And the same thing is true when it comes to gender and women and HIV prevention there, and access to treatment. And then, of course, something that is strong and that is a whole industry of its, in its own right, people who are saying, oh, and I get often letters to that, Dr. Piot, if you only would do this, we'll stop this epidemic. And I also said, anything that has the word only in there doesn't work in AIDS. We finally got rid of abstinence only. Now it's make sure that we don't get with circumcision only or whatever it is. It just doesn't work. And we just, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't make use of every single opportunity to maximize the effect of prevention, but it's not going to be that one thing. Maybe one day, but that will be only if there is a vaccine that is kind of 100% effective, which I'm not sure is around the corner. I'm actually sure it's not. And particularly if we have a vaccine, the first one will probably be only provide partial protection. So we will need to do more. So combination prevention, that was the theme of the session, the Lancet session, and nobody in his mind would, at the moment, in terms of treatment, would take out one drug and would give two drugs, although I know that that's sometimes done, but that's, frankly, that's malpractice. There's no other word. We need the same for prevention. On the left side, you see what we need for treatment. On the right side, we need prevention. And if you look very well, you see a piece of foreskin maybe also there. And it's like, you know. And it's not only the syringe and the condom, but as I said, it's also the laws. It's the system that we need. It's the protection of the rights. Oh, another myth is that there's no heterosexual transmission outside Africa. Unfortunately, it's not true. And I remember very well in the 80s that when I was working in Africa and sent an article to the you know, the New England Journal of Medicine about some female-to-male transmission, one of the referees had only one line of comment and said, it's a well-known fact that AIDS, quote-unquote, cannot be transmitted from women to men. And that's for my memoirs. I can, but of course, the reviewer was anonymous, so I don't know who could be so stupid to say that. But the fact is that heterosexual transmission of HIV can happen anywhere. But of course, there are many different degrees with the intensity that it's taking. And yesterday, I think it was yesterday, yes, that in his plenary, Jeff Garnett from Imperial College showed very clearly that we can project and model with high degrees of certainty how the epidemic is moving and evolving over the next few years, maybe even a decade. But how it will turn out in the long run, nobody can predict that. And we've had too many surprises in this epidemic to say with certainty what is not going. This is what will not happen or what will happen. This is from Asia. This is from Thailand, where you can see the evolution of transmission groups and how dynamic this epidemic still is, and how today about 40% of all new cases, it's nearly 50% in Thailand, are among partners, female partners of men who have HIV infection. But it doesn't mean that the driver of the epidemic is not either injecting drug use or commercial sex or men who have sex with men. And the final one that I would like to put here, and I think this conference has really contributed to bust that myth, that AIDS is over, that it's sorted. That message was fortunately was heard loud and clear, and also that AIDS is now a long-wave event. We've just started. So there are many more, and I'm sure each of us, we could do a poll in your environment. And why even spend time on all this? Well, I have to spend a lot of time on that, and I know Greg has a lot of... And all of us, once we go outside this building of Banamex, this is what is in the real world. So it is a reality test for the world outside Banamex, and it's our daily bread. Because these issues will come back, they're important for the future. Some are real issues, and we have to take them seriously. We should not ignore them. But I think it's really important that we stay online, and that we don't forget what our basic goals are and our basic principles. And the AIS has a real key role to play in countering these and other myths, and will be more than ever needed when we go into the long-term response. So good luck to Julio, the new, thanks to Pedro, and good luck also to Eli later on. The world needs you, and the world needs an IAS. Thank you so much.
Next, it's my pleasure to introduce for you the last speaker for the night, who brings with him a tremendous amount of experience, a wealth of knowledge. He has been at the forefront of the fight against HIV in Africa. Eli Karabira is the head of the Makarere unit. He's a professor of medicine at FRCBC in Africa. The newly elected president of the International Aid Society. And he proves the fact that you don't have to be Argentinian to be president of the International Aid Society. Eli.
Thank you very much, Urio. I had prepared fewer slides because I wanted to take this moment to talk about myself. But then I've just been reminded in reality the syndrome of the last speaker. There is no time to talk about myself, so I will go straight to talk about AIDS in Africa, context and the future directions of the IAS. I will talk about the burden of HIV in sub-Saharan Africa, the impact, the response, and then a few slides about the future directions and the concluding remarks. There is no doubt this slide is common knowledge, but deceiving. What you see here, that when you look at the global seroprevalence, it has over the years, for the last 17 years or so, it is hovered around below 1%. Whereas that of the sub-Saharan Africa has gone up, hit 6%, and then slightly gone down. And you would go away and think that majority of case patient people in South Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, the percentage is around 6%. But this is not true. It is much bigger. Here is the reality. In this particular slide, you're looking at the percentage of adults aged 15 and above living with HIV infection among female patients from 1990 to 2007. And look at the sub-Saharan graph, hovering over 50%. And of course, once the disease affects women, then there are more other problems you would expect. This is now looking at specific countries in the region whereby some of them have a seroprevalence as high as 30 to 35% and has hung in there. Now, as a consequence of infection among women is, of course, the burden in children. We know now, this is a slide from the UNAIDS of the end of 2007, whereby it is estimated that there are about 400,000 children who were infected in that year. But look at the sub-Saharan Africa, more than almost 370,000 people infected. And as a result of that, of course, the impact is the orphans and other vulnerable children. In Uganda alone, and this slide is old, but still the picture hasn't changed very much. The 2 million Ugandan children are orphaned by AIDS, and an additional 1 million currently having parents with HIV infection. Now, also we are aware what has happened as a result of the epidemic on the life expectancy in the region. Initially, we had made gains in the early 60s and 70s, but all this has come down as a result of the infection because it affects the young age group. There is also the impact on economic growth, reduced outputs, reduced productivity by mainly the households and on a smaller scale businesses. Also, there is declining savings leading to lower investments because people have to pay for health care. And of course, the catastrophic costs of illness and disability on these expenditures. As Peter Piotr has mentioned, our governments, in spite of having declared and confirmed that they will increase the health expenditure, they haven't done so. So the majority of our people have actually to rely mainly on their out-of-pocket to take care of their health care. Peter Piotr has already talked about the health systems. I don't need to say much about this. But high costs of treating HIV and related infections and cancers. Health care, of course, crowds out the needs of other patients in the wards and increased the bed occupancy because of related problems. All these have been going on for the last so many years. We also, in the early 60s, we had made gains in some of the infections, either through immunization like TB, but all these gains started coming up as a result of the epidemic. For the families and social structures, the impact has been great. The risk of lost generation, poor socialization because these children lose their parents, and in reality, the best person to take care of any child is the mother and the father. And if these die, no matter who takes care of them, there's always going to be a problem. So social upheaval, economic underclass, and so on, because they have lost their parents. Effect of losing an adult persists into the next generation. Children are withdrawn from school in order to take care of their sick parents, and this has been demonstrated in many cases, including Tanzania. Now, in spite of that, we have had a response. There have been response from the government through the ministers of health and other institutions, the internal agencies, particularly donors, UN agencies, MSF, research institutions, various communities, including civil societies, non-government organizations, local, like the TASO of Uganda, and international organizations have come out to give a helping hand. And in particular, the people living with HIV/AIDS have made a tremendous impact on the cost of the HIV infection. As a result of that, there have been demonstrable gains. For example, in this particular slide, which was 2001, shows the decline of seroprevalence in Uganda. One would say that probably if you extended this slide to today, you'd get up to zero, but that's not true. One of the dark side of success with antiretroviral therapy, that actually this slide continues to raise because those people who have died and now are alive, and they will pose a different picture. Indeed, among other responses, is the introduction of antiretroviral therapy. As some speakers have already said, before 2000, people thought that antiretroviral therapy, particularly triple therapy or HART, was unpatentable in sub-Saharan Africa because, as one said, we couldn't tell time. However, in 2003, the WHO came up with a 3x5 declaration. This was no different for many people. They thought this was no different from the declaration which was made in 1978 that by the year 2000, everybody would be healthy. Of course, that's not true, and so this was not necessary too. But there is a big difference. By the end of 2005, we had not reached 3 million as we had been told, but we had made a big way, and many countries, including Botswana and others, actually had hit their targets. So, what is the future for the IIS? With all those gains, they are there, but they are small. So, one of the things we want to do is to mobilize membership in the region, both for IIS and also for Society of AIDS in Africa, so that we can get help them to maintain what has been happening. Advocacy on HIV-AIDS-related activities in the region, including better care and prevention strategies, fighting against stigma in any form, through governments, through civil society and organizations, and through bilateral agencies. Also, we want to continue the support of the positive responses we've so far managed to get through the international pathogenesis conferences, both international and pathogenesis conferences, through the journal International AIDS Society, which is being launched today, and the IIS newsletter so that we can inform our members. Some years ago, one would say that if you use the internet, you reach very few people. I'm glad to say that even today, the best way we can communicate to our members in our region is through the internet. So that is a strategy which we want to use at the IIS. Also, we want to go through the education activities of these conferences. For example, tomorrow we'll be having a workshop on how to publish, particularly targeting young researchers whom we think and believe are the ones who are going to be the pioneers in continuing the successes which have been initiated in our days. I know Pedro and others, including me, we are not going to stay here forever. So we need to bring up the young people to take on the responsibility. Also, to disseminate relevant publications by email and so on. In conclusion, in the past 20 years, IIS has witnessed the devastation of the African region by the HIV/AIDS, the gallant response of many of the member states, the helping hand from the many international agencies, some decline of the HIV rates, and the increasing access to care, including HART. However, IIS is aware that there is a lot to be done if the region is to make a reasonable dent in the epidemic. Therefore, as a result of that, we commit ourselves to step up our services to the region to ensure sustainable positive response to the HIV epidemic in the sub-Saharan Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Ellie. We are going to skip question and answers.
due to timing. I just want to say, before we finish, there are a number of governing council members who finished their elected terms this year, and I'd just like to thank them, including Helene Gale, Scott Hammer, Andre Horban, Ian Weller, who served as our treasurer for the past for many years and has been a great support to me. I'd like to thank Jerry Kravadia, Sheila Tulu, Sukanta Kongsin, and MN Samuel, and the local co-chair of our conference, Luis Soto Ramirez, who leaves our council as well this year. Thanks to all of them. Now, before we leave, we just want to acknowledge today we had, because we didn't want to keep you here until 11 o'clock, we only had 6 out of our 10 former upcoming IAS presidents. We have something to offer them all. The 4 who are not on the panel, we love you just as much, but we just didn't want to go for 6 hours. Joop Lange and Stefano Vella, due to family illnesses, are not in Mexico. I'm wondering, is Paul Volberding or David Cooper in the audience? No? Okay. In that case, have something special for you all and for Kate, honorary president to be one day. I want to thank you all for coming. I saw so many important people in the audience. You know who you are, every single one of you, members or non-members who are working in the response to HIV. Thank you for coming, and enjoy the rest of the week.